I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order Monday, February 2nd. And we will play musical chairs from time to time. So I would like to remind people to turn their cell phones and Blackberries to the off position. And I don't mean vibrate, I mean to off. Because we've had some problems, I understand, with some of our equipment when they're trying to record the important things that are said by the constituents. Today we're going to start out with a public hearing on House Bill 2199. We will not be hearing House Bill 2354. And after 2199, we will hear the other two. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2199. And, Victoria, would you like to give us a little review of what this bill is?
I would be happy to. House Bill 2199 authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to oversee financial holding companies and bank holding companies. It eliminates the 30-day posting requirement for consumer finance license applications. It removes the requirement that DCBS set fees for banks and trusts, credit unions, and consumer finance institutions occur in a single annual rulemaking process. It repeals regulations governing savings associations which no longer apply to institutions operating in Oregon, authorizes DCBS to share information with federal agencies that regulate financial institutions, moves date on which DCBS issues calculated discount rate from the first business day of each calendar year to the second Friday in December.
Thank you. And this bill was brought forward by the governor for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So I think it'd be appropriate to have them come up first and give us an overview of the bill and why we need it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm David Tapman with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Your committee assistant is handing out my written testimony, and I'll try and work from that. I would ask those of you that have taken a look at the bill, 2199, I realize this is Grand Isle Bay, and if you saw the shadow of this bill, you'd probably want to turn away from it. It's rather lengthy. It's 42 pages. Most of that, though, are just changes in or deletions in references to certain ORS chapters, particularly Chapter 722, the Savings Association chapter that Ms. Cox just mentioned. So with that, I've tried to indicate in my remarks that this is not as extensive as it looks just by the volume. There are seven parts that I think the committee should take a look at, and I will run through that. We have been working with several representatives of the United Financial Lobby, particularly on behalf of banks and consumer finance companies, and they have raised some issues and concerns, and so I will try and touch on those too in addition to the presentation on the bill itself. The first section I'd like to draw the committee's attention to is Section 11, and that repeals our Savings Association statutes. ORS Chapter 722 provided for a mechanism to create savings associations, think of savings and loans, in Oregon. In 1995 or 1996, we adopted or revised the Oregon Bank Act. And at that time, there was a bill. The bill included provisions that created the savings bank. Now, a savings bank and a savings association are very comparable in concept, similar to savings and loan. The fact that we have two different chapters, one inside the Bank Act, 716, and one outside the Bank Act, 722, potentially leads to a fair amount of confusion. We think it makes much more sense to have a single vehicle for licensing that type of institution. The fact of the matter is there are no savings associations in Oregon right now. There haven't been for years. There are three federal savings associations, and should one choose to convert to the state, we'd like to have them use Chapter 716 to do just that. In meeting with the Oregon Bankers Association, it's my understanding they're supportive of that particular change, eliminating 722 because it has less protections for consumers, and it also does not operate within the Bank Act, where we have a pretty good handle on the various practices and the meanings of the various definitions. However, 716 itself is a little out of date, and we have pledged to work with the Oregon Bankers Association after this session to clean that up and bring that up to date. And I think with that understanding, 716 could be the best vehicle should we ever see a savings bank come into Oregon again. The next section is sharing information with the U.S. Treasury, and that is found in your bill at section 29. As you know, there's been a lot of efforts in the federal government to address concerns around the use of our banking institutions. We've heard a lot about Banking Secrecy Act, the U.S. Patriot Act, and money laundering. The goal was to establish a single clearinghouse known as the Financial Crime Enforcement Network, its acronym is FinCEN, to be the clearinghouse for all this activity. So should somebody have a complaint or should somebody file a suspicious activity report, commonly known as a SAR, they would then, the FinCEN would be the place that would take a look at that and coordinate all efforts. Our Bank Act and our Credit Union Act limit who we can share information with, and it's limited to regulators, both federal regulators and state regulators. Contrary to what most of us would think, the U.S. Treasurer's Office is not a regulator, and there's a question in the minds of many that could we share with FinCEN, a subsidiary of the Treasury's Office, that type of information. We'd like to be able to do that. We think it's the best. It's in the best interest of the public and the protection of the public, and what we want is the clarification and the direction from the legislature to do just that. So what we're asking is we get the authority to share this information, whatever information we find, whether it's suspicious activity reports filed by a bank or whether it's something else that we encounter during an examination, and share it with FinCEN. We've talked with, again, our stakeholders in the Oregon Bankers Association and the Credit Union Association of Oregon. They generally are in acceptance with this idea. They would like to make sure it's spelled out specifically to share with FinCEN and not maybe a broader group. As we know, there are a number of institutions under the U.S. Treasury's office, including the IRS, and maybe they've got some concerns there. Nonetheless, we'd like to move that forward, and we think we've got the support subject to the amendment of the specifying that it would be FinCEN we would be sharing with. Item 3 is the separation of the fee-making. Again, we have full support from all those stakeholders. Historically and currently, we've had to set fees for 3 separate programs in a single fee-setting administrative hearing. And that's very cumbersome. It ties our hands. It doesn't allow us to be responsive if there's a problem. And it also means we have to set the fees at the same time for all 3 programs, which may not be in the best interest of the programs. So currently, when we set a fee for banking, that's the same time we would set a fee for credit unions and consumer finance. And if we don't do one, then that means we can't do one for the rest of the year. This would allow us to have 3 separate fee-setting administrative hearings. And we think that's in the best interest of the 3 programs, and we have the support of the stakeholders there. The next section will be sections 34 and 35, and that has to do with the oversight of bank holding companies. Now, bank holding company is a corporation, most are here formed in Oregon, but not necessarily, that owns a bank as a subsidiary. That's a very popular version of corporate formation in the banking industry. It allows for the raising of funds in different mechanism than a bank can raise. Preferred trust instruments can be used to raise funds. It also has certain implications, as I understand, for tax benefits. Right now, we have 35 banks. Of those 35 banks chartered in Oregon, 24 of those banks have bank holding companies. So that's a fairly common practice in the state of Oregon. In fact, it's a common practice throughout the United States. We have the authority to go in and conduct an examination of a bank holding company. Now, we don't have the mandate that we have to go in periodically and do an exam like we do of a bank. Banks, we're mandated to examine no less than every 24 months, and as you know, we're on approximately a 12-month cycle right now. Bank holding companies, however, we do maybe on a for-cause basis. Should we see something when we do an examination of a bank that makes us question what's going on at the parent holding company, we then would for-cause go in and do this examination. From our perspective, that is problematic because we do not have a corresponding authority to take some type of enforcement action if we find something wrong with the bank holding company. And oftentimes it has to do with making sure the bank is adequately funded or that members of the board of directors of that bank holding company are well-versed in the practices and have a background that we would think is one that is beyond any question. Should somebody run afoul of law or something like that, we believe that the bank holding company, in protecting the reputation of the bank, that board of directors should be subject to oversight and control. Typically, we would ask to have someone removed. If someone wasn't removed, that could be problematic. The only remedy right now for enforcement is if we turn to our counterparts in the Federal Reserve Bank. Federal Reserve Bank, the closest one, is in San Francisco. They're subject to oversight by the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. If we find something that we're concerned about, we would have to refer to the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. In turn, they would forward that to Washington, D.C., have their board review it, and then send the response back to San Francisco, who would then respond to the bank holding company. We think that's a problem. We think that that's the potential for a fair amount of harm can come during that kind of expansive time frame. At this point, we don't anticipate needing to use this. We have not had a need to use this in the past, but we think it is a poor regulatory practice to give someone authority and responsibility for conducting exams without corresponding enforcement authority. During these times and these circumstances, we know the Federal Reserve Bank is busy. They take a look at the things that are highest on their chart, and they, by practice, do not come in and routinely do examinations of all bank holding companies. They work off the largest ones, as you can imagine, in any bank that holding company that holds a bank under $1 billion, is not typically subject to any type of examination by them. So we think that this is part and parcel of the dual banking system, where we both have authority to go in and conduct examinations. Likewise, we should both have authority to conduct enforcement. You will find in that packet of information a letter from the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. I'll use the acronym CSBS. They're the institution that comes through and examines all state bank supervisors and accredits state bank supervisors. We are subject to accreditation, and that accreditation is reviewed every 7 years. We have our state bank supervisor examiners. Our examiners for state banks are subject to training through them, and they also become certified to certain specific classes and subject matter expertise. So the CSBS is well-versed in both oversight of banks and also oversight of bank state bank supervisors. And when they came through and did the last accreditation in 2007, they noted that this was a deficiency, in their opinion, of our authority to enforce our own laws, and they recommended that we go forward with this legislative proposal. And you'll see a letter in there from CSBS recommending just such an act sent to Chair Holvey and to the members of the committee. I will note, before moving off this point, that over half the states have similar powers. And again, it's not something that's routinely used. In fact, it should be rarely, if ever, used. But it's part of the toolbox of tools that we think is necessary as effective regulators. Next section I want to call to the committee's attention is Section 36. That's Section 5 of my testimony. And it's regarding a change to bank holding company reports. Bank holding companies are required to file reports both with us and the Federal Reserve Bank. Historically, and under current law, they file those reports in written format. And that format is identical for both the state and the federal government. What we would like to do is move into the 21st century and allow for filing through electronic means and allow us to tell the bank or the bank holding company that we don't need a certain documentation. We only need aspects of what they send to the Federal Reserve Bank. We believe this is part of regulatory streamlining and would be beneficial to the holding company when it allow us to focus on those things that are necessary to us and not extraneous information. Next section has to do with a posting requirement. Again, an effort to bring our financial services oversight into the 21st century. This has to do with consumer finance licensing. This is a requirement that we're trying to eliminate that requires a 30-day posting upon receipt of an application to become licensed as a consumer finance lender in the state of Oregon. Last session, we asked this committee to eliminate a similar charge for pawnbrokers. We met with no resistance, and it just makes sense in this day and age where we don't have a public hearing, we don't have people come down to Salem to check postings and to comment on those postings, that a 30-day delay through the mechanics of just putting something up on a bulletin board outside our office serves no real function. And we would ask the committee to eliminate that requirement. We understand that the Consumer Finance or the Financial Services Association of Oregon is supportive of this concept. The last piece I'd like to touch on is Section 46, and this has to do with the timing of the calculation for the consumer finance charge for lenders. As Ms. Cox pointed out, we currently adopt a consumer finance lending index annually, and it's to be done the first business day of each new year. The problem is it takes effect immediately upon adoption by our agency. This does not allow for the consumer finance companies to update their computers, change their forms to reflect that change. What we're asking for is simply to move that back to the second, second week in December, so that once it's adopted, that gives us time to get the word out, and it gives the companies time to change their forms and their computer information. We think this is again, not a controversial issue. We think it's beneficial to the industry, and again, we have support from the consumer finance lobby. In addition, Mr. Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, has indicated he would like this committee to look at the potential for addressing which index is used to calculate the interest rate that is used to set a cap on consumer finance loans. As you probably remember, last session in 2007, a cap was adopted for consumer finance lending that reflected a similar cap for short-term lending and payday lending and title lending. And that's 36% or a certain percentage above, based on a certain index, above 30%. So if the index takes you up more than 6%, then the interest rate could be above 36%. Currently, that's not an issue, but we can see that day could be coming where inflation comes back to visit, and we'd like to make sure we get that index right. As my testimony indicates, we don't have a real concern which index is selected. Mr. Cosgrove would like to make sure the one that he believes was intended is, in fact, the one that is in use. Our only concern is we want to make sure whatever index is used, that it's fair both to the consumer and to the businesses, that it reflects any current trend so that it isn't out of balance with whatever inflationary trends are going on. Secondly, that the selected index eliminates confusion and not bring more confusion to the situation, so that we make sure it is in fact tied to a real index and not one that is artificially created. And then third, we want to make sure that the lenders that are consumer finance lenders in Oregon understand this is still an annual rate, and no matter how much that rate index rate fluctuates during the course of a year, when it's adopted at the date and time, it stays that way for a whole year. So we're a little concerned if you get something that's tied to a very active rate that fluctuates up and down, there may be lenders and consumers that end up getting confused by that. We think that's not a real problem and it's a matter of education, but we just want to make sure that on the record we express that concern. As I've indicated, the Oregon Bankers Association has come forward, and we've met with them on several occasions, and they've raised with our agency a few concerns, mostly around the question of the bank holding companies and the need for enforcement rather than just examination authority. We think that's an important and has merit going forward, but we understand they have concerns, and we've talked with them, and we're encouraged that we can continue to have dialogues with them. At this point, we believe we've landed at the right spot and do think that enforcement's important, but we also pledge to continue to talk with them. And so having put that on the record, I have one last request, and that is at one point there was a request to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means based on the fact that the word fees were in this bill. However, the fees are not changing. We're not promoting any additional fees. There is no fee increase or, for that matter, decrease. And so we think it was an erroneous referral, and we would ask the committee and the chair to have that referral withdrawn. And so with that, I will conclude my testimony and answer any questions that the committee may have.
Any questions from the committee? Mr. Tapman, you always do such a thorough job that you leave no questions for people. But I'm sure as we study this bill, there probably will be some. And as we hear more of the other issues come up, there might be some more as well.
I'm happy to stick around, Mr. Chair. And if there's any follow-up you need, I'll be
there. And I appreciate that. If you at least stay through the end of this particular public hearing on this particular bill.
I'll be here for all of them.
Thanks. Next up, I have Paul Cosgrove.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, here to testify about one small issue that is on page 39 of your bill in line 7. Mr. Tapman mentioned some of the issue that I wanted to discuss with you, but basically this dates back to 2007 when on the Senate side, when 2187 was moved to the Senate side, there was discussion in the House on the floor, but an amendment was made to provide that the rate cap on consumer finance companies, should we get into a period of hyperinflation, could have an upper end 30 percentage points in excess of the discount rate in lieu of the 36% flat rate. That was an amendment that was made on the Senate side, if I recall correctly, and the problem is that in the rush of the end of the session, Legislative Council picked up a rate that's been sitting in Oregon statute for years and years and years, and frankly, it does not exist in the Federal Reserve System. The rate that was used in the legislation, you can see it on line 7 on page 39, is a discount rate on 90-day commercial paper. There is no discount rate on 90-day commercial paper. There is a 90-day non-financial commercial paper rate, and there is a discount rate, which is technically called the discount window primary credit rate. My understanding and recollection is that all of the testimony, all of the comments on the floor and elsewhere when this issue is being discussed, everybody used the shorthand discount rate. And had we not been quite so rushed, I think the problem wouldn't have occurred and we would have gotten the correct designation of discount rate, a discount window primary credit rate rather than the old non-existent discount rate on 90-day commercial paper. So the amendment we would like to bring before you when you consider a work session on this bill is to delete 5 words on line 7 and insert 4 words so that we meet one of the standards that Mr. Tapman mentioned, which is a rate that we all know what it is, that it isn't confusing, that it isn't ambiguous, and that it exists and easily accessible to all of us. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So what is the name of that rate?
It is the line
that
7
that you're proposing.
Line 7 would read 30 percentage points in excess of the discount, and then you would insert these 4 words, window primary credit rate, and that would be the end of the line, and then it would say in effect in the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco, as it is proposed to be amended by the department. That is, I think the department agrees, what everybody generally calls the discount rate as a shorthand, and that's what the discussion was.
So what would happen if the Federal Reserve, in all their wisdom, because they certainly have a lot of it, decides to change the name of the rate?
Mr. Chairman, it's an extra question, and that's what happened because Legislative Council picked up a statutory recitation to a rate that was in existence many years ago that no longer is. I don't know that there's anything other than we'd have to come back at the next available time and amend it to deal with a new rate. And the problem is we have to have something that we all know what it is, that really does exist, that's easily accessible, for which there's no dispute of what it is. The rate I mentioned is available on the Federal Reserve's website, and that is helpful for everybody, the regulators and the regulated. But I don't know that there's another way around the problem when we're referring to a federal rate if they change their terminology to do anything other than come back at the next available time and change our statute to conform to the new terminology.
Well, let me run another alternative by you, see if you're comfortable with it. I'm not going to guess whether you are or not. But what if we left that a discount rate that was established by DCBS by rule at that whenever they're supposed to do it? As long as it's a real rate and everybody knows what it is. I mean, then we wouldn't have to be putting a definition into statute that may in fact change in a couple of years.
Mr. Chairman, I'd want to talk to my members to see if they're comfortable with that, but the immediate reaction I have is that we're either going to have to change rules, which is a process, or change a statute if the feds change. Now, I can assure you that the feds haven't changed these names very frequently. It's just that when you're dating back to the 80s, and we pick up 80s terminology in this decade, they have changed it between then and now. So I don't know that it's a very frequently occurring problem that we would be facing. But as I say, I think you'd either have to change rules or change a statute. I think we'd be more comfortable having it sit in the statute. I expect that's what my members would tell me, but I haven't asked that question.
Thank you. It just seems like it'd be more responsive and quicker to change if it was in rule. But, you know, you may not be comfortable with that. But
well, if I just might mention, Mr. Chairman, actually, this body is sometimes quicker than rulemaking processes in some of our agencies. So we have been dealing with a rulemaking at DCBS, and we've been discussing it now for about a year. So you're
can I actually, quote you on that?
You're welcome to.
Well, on the record.
You're welcome to.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Cosgrove?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next up, we have Tim Martinez and Ken Shellman.
Oh, geez.
I think. Shellman?
Sherman.
Jeez. It was simpler than I thought.
Brilliant. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Joining me is longtime OBA counsel Ken Sherman. It's probably my penmanship. My dad really wanted a right-hander instead of a left-hander, so I think my arm was tied for my first 10 years of my life. So hardly anybody can read my writing, which sometimes comes in handy, sometimes not so much. First of all, I would like to thank DCBS for working with us on 2199. I will say for anybody on the dais who thinks that state government moves slowly, we met with them at 11:30 today, and I was chuckling to myself as I read these testimonies that they already had incorporated some of the things we talked about at that meeting. So state government can indeed move quickly. I would say that on most of the issues where they indicate we support, we obviously have to go take that back to our membership, but I think it's fairly likely that we will indeed support them. Right now, I would say we don't object to them, but I have no doubt we will get to the support position, and we're continuing to work on some language with them on some of these issues. I would like to, if it's okay, Mr. Chairman, give a little background. You have several freshmen on the committee, and I'd like to just take a couple minutes to talk about the Oregon Bankers Association relationship with DCBS. We do work very closely. I will tell you, and it's not in this class, and it's not in the last class or the class before that, but one time in the 15 years that I've represented the Oregon Bankers Association, I had a new freshman come up to me and said, I'm introducing a bill that you're going to like. And I said, what's that going to be? And it's going to be the elimination of the state chartered bank. We'll just all have federal banks. So, okay, that's an interesting idea, and probably within an hour, I got a call from DCBS asking me if I knew this new member and would I be willing to talk to them about the values of a dual chartered banking system. Of course I did, and that bill was actually never dropped, and I think to this day that member would say thank you for not letting me, you know, put my foot in my mouth. I give that as background to say that we are very strong believers, as is DCBS, in the dual chartered banking system.
And that wasn't me, was it?
No, it was not.
Oh.
It's nobody on the dais.
Just wanted to check.
And, you know, we are very strong believers in that. We were very closely with that, with those folks, both at the state and federal level. And I would also add that I've never seen the group that Mr. Tapman added the letter from. Let me go back to make sure I don't misstate it. The Conference of State Bank Supervisors ever see a state law that they didn't like when it came to regulating banks. I mean, that's their job. They want to see a very strong dual-chartered system, and they are always interested in enhancing that at the state level. Now, having said that, we also worked with DCBS last fall. They came to us and said, we need more bank examiners. We're going to go to eBoard and ask for authority to hire some new bank examiners. We worked very well with them. Again, I thank them for their willingness to work with us. And we actually, my boss, Linda Navarro, the president of the Bankers Association, and Corey Streisinger, the head of DCBS, sat at a dais like this and testified in favor of hiring those new examiners. One of the main points we made during that hearing, and frankly, those of you who've been around a while know it's not very often that the eBoard takes testimony on specific issues. So we're very, very pleased that they let us do that. One of the pieces that we added strongly supportive of was that it wasn't so much that they needed new bodies, which we were supportive of. They needed quality folks, and that's one of the things that they're focused on, and again, we commend them for that, that they're looking for folks that have the experience and background to do that. One of the problems they faced is that Oregon doesn't exactly pay very well for those entry-level positions, and we've supported efforts to increase salaries for those folks, and in fact, I think you're going to see, or at least Ways and Means will see, that the assessments for banks are going to go up this year in order to help pay for that increased quality of examination, which we strongly support, not only for our banks, but obviously for Oregon and its bank customers. So all that is kind of background for the one issue we still disagree on, and that is the bank holding company piece. There may indeed be 25 banks or 25 states that have this authority. I've asked DCBS, and we're going to do our own research to see what states around us do, to see if they are part of those 25 states or where those states are. I can't answer that question today, but I would just leave you with a couple comments and thoughts on this, and then Ken Sherman, who's been around since, was Abraham Lincoln turning down that territorial governorship when you started? I can't quite remember, but Ken's been around a while. He is the one that did most of the work with the department when the Bank Act was rewritten in 1997. I will say, when you're at home in your districts and you can't fall asleep some nights, and you look through the statutes and you start reading the Bank Act, Ken Sherman had a lot to do with writing almost the entire act, or at least working very closely with those that were writing it. So what we've asked the department is to show us some examples of problems. Show us where it's not working. We think it's important before you pass a new law that you have reasons, or you can show where things have not worked to the betterment of Oregon and its citizens. Yes, it is true that if there is an issue that they see, they do have to forward it on to the Federal Reserve. In our experience, the Federal Reserve has been fairly responsive in getting back to the state and in taking that required action. I would also say that those of you that are watching the Congress at all realize that this is probably going to be the biggest year for financial services in Congress since probably the Great Depression. We expect, and I can bring you a list or be happy to provide the administrator with a list of the topics that we think Congress is going to look at this year. So we encourage this committee and the legislature to go slow on an issue like this. I do again appreciate the willingness of the department to meet with us. We are going to meet again on this issue and make sure we have the language right on the other pieces that we have agreed to remain neutral on, if not support. But I think it is important that we work with the department to see if we can't come to some kind of agreement on this. The last piece I would say is on the Ways and Means referral. It is somewhat difficult to expect taking on new responsibility not costing anything. I mean, I think that seems to be would be common sense to most of us. Again, we'd like to work through that issue before you remove that referral. But I would also say, even if there isn't a fee to that holding company expansion. This has been Oregon law since 1987. It was put in, my belief is, by the through the Ways and Means process, where they divided up these or put all these fees together. And I think that you know, you might want to check with members of the Ways and Means Committee to see if they would like to at least include that as they go through their budget process for DCBS in the 2009-2011 biennium. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or let Mr. Sherman say his piece. It's very rarely, and I'll say this to the committee, it's very rarely that I talk more than our counsel, so I apologize for that.
Oh, thank you. Welcome, and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ken Sherman, and I'm an attorney here in Salem. I've had the privilege of representing the Oregon Bankers Association since 1977, and I was very privileged to be a part of the process. I had a much less vaunted role than the one that Mr. Martinez just described, but I was on the committee that participated in rewriting the Bank Act back in 1987. I will say also that although I'm the lawyer up here, you're going to hear considerably fewer words from me than you just heard from Tim, so we know you have other business to get to. I just reiterate that back in 1987, when we got to Chapter 715, which is where the holding company rules are contained, we spent a fair amount of time discussing the whole approach to regulating holding companies. And holding companies are, I'm sorry, did I say 87? 97. Yep. Holding companies are kind of a different creature because though they are chartered, a state bank's holding company is chartered by the state of Oregon. It's an Oregon corporation. The federal law gives the primary regulatory authority to the Federal Reserve Board, and there's quite a body of law called the Bank Holding Company Act, which has been in existence for many years and which is very detailed in its regulation of holding companies. I think it's fair to say that our goal is that we have good, efficient regulation, and that we avoid, as I think Cecil Monroe, who was the chairman or the superintendent of banks in 1997 and who chaired our committee, avoid any duplication of regulation, avoid any situation where you've got one regulator saying go that way and another regulator saying go that way. That doesn't produce necessarily a good result. So we have had good meetings with the department. We will continue those efforts. I'm confident that we can find common ground, but as one of those new fellows back in Washington, D.C. said last week, our goal is not to have more regulation, it's to have more effective regulation, and I think that's a common goal that we share with the department. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I'm going to start out with one then, and I really appreciate you coming forward and talking about this, and I would hope that we would get amendments, you know, on everything that everybody agrees on, so we can at least move forward to that and then have an amendment on the disagreement, you know, to look at separately. But around the bank holding companies, you know, when you were speaking about, you know, having regulators going this way and that way, but also recognizing that we should have more effective and more, you know, streamlined regulation, if the regulation that they're enforcing is the same regulation that the Federal Reserve uses, what would be the potential problems that you see in having the state be able to do that compliance if it was basically the same regulation they were enforcing?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think for the most part there would not be a lot of problem as long as you're dealing with the same rule. But these are very complex rules, and there's always that difference of perspective from a state regulator versus a federal regulator who's looking at not just Oregon but at 50 states, some of which have very different laws. So I've just been around the process long enough to know that it's possible if you get two well-meaning regulators into a single situation that they can create a convergence which is not doesn't produce a clear result. And that's it's something we've never had to deal with because we've had the current situation since well before 1997. What we did in 1997 with holding companies was not a course change. We stayed the course, and it was because Mr. Monroe was convinced that we already had the best regulatory scheme for holding companies, where we chartered them here and we had oversight here. We had reporting that was shared with the state officials, but the enforcement responsibility lay with the Federal Reserve Board. He was convinced that that worked. There was no evidence to the contrary, and that's why we stayed the course.
Thank you. And I assume that we have federally chartered institutions that are owned by bank holding companies that under this bill we wouldn't be able to regulate anyway. Is that a fair statement?
Well, you have federally chartered institutions, Mr. Chairman, but if their holding company is chartered by the state of Oregon, then it's an Oregon corporation. So I assume, and I've never really had occasion to look into that, but I assume that there would be the same degree of oversight there. I'm just not sure. I'd be interested.
Let me rephrase my question then. So we have a federally chartered institution that's owned by a bank holding company in another state.
Mm-hmm.
And the bank operates here. Would we be able to regulate that bank holding company here in Oregon?
Under this bill? Under this bill. I'd really defer to Mr. Tapman on that question, but I don't think so. I'd really be interested to know what he'd say, but I haven't looked at it from that standpoint. But I don't think that's... I think they would focus on Oregon corporations that were bank holding companies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He's agreeing.
We'll get him to answer that question in a minute. Questions from the committee? Representative Widener.
If this was to go into legislation, do you think it might cause some of the holding companies to move out of the state and into other states?
Well, that's a possibility. Another possibility is conversion of charter from a federal charter or from a state charter to a federal charter. And there's always that tension. That's what the dual banking system, I think, is all about, is that you've got two different regulators of the federal system with the national banks and then the state banks. And there is some degree of competition, I think, usually fairly low-key, between those two as they compete. And the Conference of State Bank Commissioners have always been very, very supportive of the dual banking system and wanting to make sure that we have a strong state charter. But as these things change, I think there is certainly some risk of having banks convert their charters.
Further questions? Don't see any at the moment. I was just kind of curious. You know, Mr. Martinez mentioned that some legislator came up with a bill to do away with state chartered banks, and you know, since we're always fighting about, you know, the regulation of state chartered versus federal chartered, and we certainly don't want to over-regulate the state chartered, as because then we're giving an advantage to the federal charter. Way back in your history, what was the reason for having the dual banking system of state chartered and then having a separate regulation for federal chartered?
Well, I think we had the federal banks first, the national banking system. The National Bank Act is very old. I think the phenomenon of having state chartered banks is much more recent, like the 20s and the 30s. And I think they were part of the populist movement, particularly popular out west and in the Midwest. And you have states back in the Midwest where, you know, you still have 400 or 500 banks and little tiny states with half the population of Oregon, most of those being state chartered banks. But I think it's just a more political accident than anything else that we've ended up with this dual charter system. But I think it served us well because national banks have their strengths, and we have a number of very strong national banks. Some of our larger banks here in Oregon are, and that's true elsewhere, are national banks. But we also have that constant refreshment in the marketplace of, and I'll bet every one of you at some point in your lives have seen this happen, where the big bank in town does something that maybe wasn't the smartest thing in hindsight, and next thing you know, there's a new bank on the corner, and it's almost always going to be a state chartered bank that comes in. So it's a way that the banking system refreshes itself, and it's pure capitalism, I think, at its best.
And Mr. Chairman, if I can just add real briefly, again, you know, the OBA, Oregon Bankers Association, is very, Tim Martinez, very strongly supportive of the dual chartered system. If you find yourself in Alessandro's, for example, anytime this session, look right across the street, Pioneer Trust Bank, certainly not one of the largest banks in the state, is a national bank. You know, when folks sit down and decide we're going to put our money together, seek investors, and start a bank, nowadays they very carefully weigh those two charters. Do I want to be nationally chartered or state chartered? A lot of the local banks are state chartered because they do appreciate having the person on the ground here in Oregon and not having to deal with somebody in Washington, D.C. Others look at the regulations and say, you know what, I'd rather be chartered nationally. So we are very supportive of the dual chartered system. You will never see us say anything in testimony opposing that, but it is an option. Folks should be able to make that, you know, looking at both charters, and our concern here on the holding company expansion as far as regulation is the fact that it looks like it's going to be dual, the same power looked at by the state and the federal folks.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This whole issue is totally new to me, and so I feel like I'm in the middle and I really don't know how to get out. So are you objecting to the whole legislation or just portions of the list? Portions, it would be really helpful for me to know which portions and how I can find them, and okay. It would be even more helpful if you were to give me something in writing so I could look back at this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, members of the committee, I will be more than happy to sit down and visit with you, provide you something in writing. I'm sorry we weren't clear. We support virtually everything in this bill. We've worked very closely with the department on the bill. They've listened to our concerns in several areas. We're working on drafting language. We'll have language to the committee that we both agreed upon. So the majority of this bill we support. The specific sections that we have problems with, I believe, are 34 and 35.
That's right.
But I will make an appointment with your staff to sit down and go through our specific objections with you, if that would be helpful.
That would be great. Thank you. And if I could have something in writing, that's always helpful.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Representative Tomei. You bring up a good point that having things in writing sometimes helps when we go back to look at a particular bill to make a decision. If we don't, you know, have any written testimony to refer back to, where you're relying on our judgment and our memory, which sometimes gets a little foggy with all the bills we have. So, further questions? Representative Widener?
Section 36 is okay in it?
Mm-hmm. 36 is the one that expands the reporting requirement on holding companies, and
yes.
We
right.
Didn't have a problem
we
with that.
Any problem. Okay.
It's really 34 and 35.
Thank you. I appreciate your conciseness and your specific testimony to help us through this. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any other questions before they get down? I didn't see any, so I didn't want to make sure I left anybody out. Nope. Thank you very much. Mr. Tapman, would you like to come back up and maybe put yourself on the record for the answer to the question I asked, which hopefully you remember?
Mr. Chair, you had many great questions, and I'm not sure which one you need answered. Dave Tapman, for the record again, with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. There are several good questions that were raised, and I will try and answer any and all of them. I'm not sure I have all the answers available. I do want to reiterate just to where we get started is that, yes, we have worked closely with the Oregon Bankers Association, and yes, we do have a good working relationship with them and with all our financial services stakeholders, and that's something that's a reflection on their commitment as well as ours to making sure that Oregonians and Oregonians, both consumers and businesses, are well served and protected. The You had a couple of questions about the preference in charter, and I'm not quite sure if that's what you wanted to discuss, or was it something around something more specific?
I knew you were going to test my memory.
Mr. Chair, if you don't remember, I can help you.
Oh, Vice Chair Riley, he's my memory today.
His question was about whether or not the state would be able to regulate holding companies out of state.
Oh. I believe... Representative Riley and Chair Holby, I believe that, as Mr. Sherman put it, if the holding company was incorporated in a foreign state, so it was not an Oregon corporation, and the bank was a nationally chartered bank, we would have no jurisdiction over either. And that makes sense. Our whole goal here is to address questions of making sure that state chartered banks, Oregon state chartered banks, are safe and sound, and that our depositors are protected, and that the shareholders are protected. And so our focus would be on that. And I think I just want to reiterate what sections 34 and 35 attempt to do is to ensure if we see something when we do a bank exam, we are not going to go forward and conduct examinations of holding companies. That's not our mandate. If we see something when we do a routine safety and soundness examination of a bank that makes us say we need to go look at a bank holding company, we will then follow up. That will be few and far between. There will be no anticipated additional cost. In fact, if there's any cost involved, we will absorb that with our current staff. So there is no fiscal impact, if you will. And our anticipation is if it's a problem, we will be talking to the Federal Reserve Bank about that problem and work to come up with a satisfactory resolution to the problem that all parties, both the FRB, our office, and the respondent bank, agree upon. It would be highly unlikely we would get in that situation that Mr. Martinez identified where we may disagree and go in two different directions. That doesn't make sense. We work with our federal counterparts on a daily basis. Every examination that we do of a bank is done in conjunction with the FDIC, the Federal Depository Insurance Corporation, and day-to-day there are differences, and we sit down and we work those differences out. There's no reason why it would be any different in this situation. All we're saying is we think this is a prophylactic tool that we should have in our toolbox. If there was something to come up, we would want to address that problem without letting it grow to the point where we have to rely on Washington, D.C. to respond to it and take 2 to 3 weeks to get it resolved. And that's really the genesis of why we're here.
So let me follow up on Representative Riley's reiteration of my question. Would it be possible under law to have a bank holding company from a foreign state own a state chartered bank here in Oregon?
And Mr. Chair, yes. The answer is yes.
And would, in that case, would you be able to, under this bill, regulate that bank holding company?
Mr. Chair, I believe that would be the case. The bank holding company would be subject to holding and owning a Oregon state chartered bank. Therefore, our responsibility to the bank would evolve to that holding company.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I'm just trying to follow up on the previous people who testified. So as I understand what you're saying, that the federal organization would FRB, right?
Is that Federal Reserve Bank? Yes, ma'am.
They would be able to do this oversight. But what I'm reading here and what I'm hearing you say is that a state can move more quickly. If you see a problem, you can move more quickly to address the problem. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, that's exactly our point. We believe that if there's a time where expedience requires us to move quickly, we want to be able to do that. Again, to reiterate, this has not been a problem. This is more a proactive approach. Secondly, most of the time, if this was to come up, we would be working with the FRB to resolve it collectively. But should there be a real problem, we want to be able to act quickly to protect Oregonians. And that's our purpose.
Follow up.
Thank you. So as we've seen recently in the banking industry, there have been huge problems. People have lost billions and billions of dollars. So if you had this authority, then it seems to me from what you're saying and from the little that I've read here, that you would be able to step in quickly if there were these kinds of problems coming up. Am I correct in assuming that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, without overstating it, I don't know that we could have resolved or fixed many of the problems that have come up. Should there be a situation where we feel a Oregon Chartered Bank is impacted by something that took place at the holding company level, for instance, if it was a funding situation and the bank was inadequately funded and the holding company had the wherewithal to do just that, we on our own could talk to the holding company and say, we need you to increase the funding, increase the capital.
Under these new regulations, you
correct.
Could do that.
Right now, we could do an examination and
but
say,
you can't.
You've got this funding, but we can't order them to do that. We would have to go to the Federal Reserve Bank, and hopefully the Federal Reserve Bank would then go, as I say, to D.C., and D.C. would order them to do that.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
A couple quick questions here. Now, you said it's about a 2 to 3 week process if you have to go to the Federal Bank, is what you testified earlier.
Chair Holby and Representative Widener, that was my guesstimate of how you get something on the agenda. Do they have an expedited process? They may. Our experience with them is things move pretty slowly in Washington, D.C. But I can't tell you it would be a 2 to 3 if they move quickly.
And my next question is, if we were to do this, what's to stop banks, rather than us having the tax base here, but them to start forming Nevada or Idaho holding companies so they can get out of the regulation that you're placing on them here? What fiscal impact could that have on us if they start moving to other states?
Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, it is my belief that the fact that they shifted their holding company from an Oregon-based corporation to a Nevada-based corporation would not change our ability to do just what we're describing. It would only be if they changed the bank, and then, of course, they're pulling the bank out, and that would destroy the whole purpose behind having a bank in Oregon. They've got the relationships in Oregon. They've got the knowledge. Most of our state chartered banks are based on relationship and locale. You'll find that most of our bank officers and bank presidents have a standing level of experience in the community where they're in. It would make no sense for them to pull out of the state itself.
Hello?
Yeah. But switching their charter to federal, you'd have no authority over them. But if they're a state charter, and that's what I'm wondering, you know, the big buildings that are downtown, some of the different ones, just switching their charters altogether so they're not under your regulation, or possibly moving their corporate headquarters to get out of the... They'd still have their bank here, but they can move a big portion of their employees, possibly, if they're under more regulation in the state.
Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, most of our bank holding companies hold a single asset, and that's the bank itself. And they're relatively small banks. Relative, I say. You know, we've got some large banks in your mind and my mind, but they're relatively small compared to the national banks. Most of what they hold are those banks. They're not going to be moving a vast number of employees out because a vast number of employees are related to the retail day-to-day banking operations. The holding companies are essentially just a vehicle for raising funds. As I said, they have certain benefits by using a holding company, whether it's the ability to issue a certain type of stock that's beneficial for both tax purposes and for accounting purposes, or just a tax benefit in general. The structure of the bank holding company is really designed to, it doesn't have much day-to-day impact on the operations of our local banks. I can't imagine a situation where if an Oregon corporation was a bank holding company and they said, well, we're frustrated that Oregon's doing something we don't like, we're moving to Nevada, that would have a major impact on that bank. The bank is still chartered here in Oregon, and they're not going to undo that charter. And we still would have the ability to reach through and touch that bank holding company, even though it's chartered in Nevada under that scenario.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming back up and clarifying the question that Representative Riley remembered. And I hope that we can, you know, work on the amendments that we do have consensus around, and certainly we'll have an amendment where there's disagreement as well, so we can make that decision individually would be my preference. And appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We look forward to bringing those amendments back to you.
Thank you very much. I don't see anybody else signed up for House Bill 2199. At the moment. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2199. And we will open up a hearing on House Bill 2383. And with that, I think we will have Representative Nathanson, if she's so willing, come up and tell us a little bit about House Bill 2383. And before you do that, Victoria, would you like to give us a brief description of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2383 provides a 14-day right of first refusal to tenants association for any offer to sell a manufactured dwelling, park, or marina.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Nathanson. I'm a representative from District 13, which is North Eugene. Last session, we passed legislation that allows residents of manufactured home parks to form associations or co-ops to purchase their park so that they could remain in their home and in their neighborhood. This bill would give added meaning to this action, giving them a crack at buying the park so they could actually remain in their neighborhood. It says simply that the owner must notify the residents of the intent to sell and give them 14 days to come up with an offer to buy the park. If they can match the offer, their offer is considered first. The owner would be able to sell in either case, but this bill would enable existing neighborhoods to remain intact and prevent the loss of some of Oregon's affordable housing. From a report that I was reviewing this weekend, I have collected the following information. In Connecticut, Florida, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Rhode Island, residents already have the right of first refusal on receiving notice of an impending sale of the community. There are about 66,000 manufactured homes or mobile homes in these parks in Oregon. Nearly 800 of those are in my district in North Eugene. This is affordable housing that already exists. We know how devastating it is to lose a home. Let's not lose the affordable housing that we already have. It's much cheaper to keep what we have than to figure out how to build something new that we don't have yet. National sources show that the average household size in homes such as these is 2.3 persons, and slightly more than half nationally are employed full-time. So while some of the residents of these homes are the working poor, others are often very vulnerable, medically or financially. Moving is often not an option because the homes are so old they can't be moved, or there is no place to move the home to. The residents here often share a very strong sense of community. The social network is strong and supportive for those who are unable to take care of themselves with their daily needs, especially the disabled and elderly. When a park is closed, a neighborhood, an entire community, is wiped out. This bill will help preserve those neighborhoods. Since 1997, there have been 70 park closures in Oregon, a loss of nearly 2,800 spaces. So what happens when a park closes? It's hard to say. We don't have statistics, but I have discussed this with people who know, people who've lived in them, or people who provide the social services to those who are going to be or have been displaced. I think we can say reasonably that many of these most vulnerable residents who depend on their neighbors for help with daily living will be unable to relocate their home to another park. They will be unable to find suitable housing with that social network intact, and many will end up moving into assisted living facilities or nursing homes at a much greater cost and expense. The cost is either to them or to the state. Under current law, manufactured home park owners are required to, quote, negotiate in good faith and provide an opportunity to purchase the facility. The current statute creates confusion, honestly, for both parties because it's not clear what is required for that negotiation. While the intent might sound good, it's not clear so that the residents don't, in fact, have a shot at buying their park. So how tough will this be for park owners? I don't think it would be that tough because the waiting period that's described here is very short. A couple of weeks doesn't seem an onerous burden, and especially knowing that there is already a tax advantage for the owners to sell to the residents, since the capital gains from sale of a mobile home park to a tenants association is exempt. That's how I've understood this to work. We say we value home ownership. We should be prepared not only to encourage home ownership, but to step in and help people keep the homes they already own. When Oregon first started legislating to help mobile home park tenants, and remember, they own their homes, but they are tenants on the property, they have owned their home for a long time. Many of the mobile homes were built at a time when they were just that, mobile. Now we have manufactured homes that are constructed and moved to site. But many of those aging homes just cannot be moved because of structural weakness. Preserving affordable housing is far less expensive than developing new affordable housing. The cost of having so many people displaced will become an increased burden to the state. It has the potential to cost a significant amount of money to put displaced tenants in new low-income housing, and it will increase our costs for social services. As I've discussed this with several colleagues and proponents, other good suggestions have been made to clarify or strengthen this bill, and I'd be pleased to help with preparing amendments if the committee thinks that that's desirable. This bill would help preserve neighborhoods, save pain and suffering, and save money. So I ask for your consideration of this idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. I was curious, did you wish to testify on House Bill 2255 as well, or just, I'm not asking it, you to, I'm just, I didn't
know.
Not
at this time.
Okay, thank you. Questions of the good representative from Eugene. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but when we heard this last session, one of the things I asked is, why don't we give right of first refusal? And I was, and the reason I ask is because my parents lived in a mobile home park in Florida where they have this right, and actually the association exercised that right, and the people who lived in the park were able to stay put, own their own home, and in fact, my father fortunately was able to help some people who couldn't afford to stay, and so everyone who lived there was able to stay, and this is a great idea. I'm hoping that we will be able to move forward on this. However, one question is 2 weeks enough?
Mr. Chair and Representative Riley, I think the bill could be strengthened to help preserve neighborhoods if it were a longer period of time. Upon reflection, that is a very short amount of time to pull together the financial resources and sometimes the legal assistance to work through what it would take to assemble probably multiple sources of money to make such a financial commitment.
Thank you.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thank you for appearing in front of us. This is, I believe, probably as important to my district as it is yours. And I just wanted to follow up on Representative Riley's, I think, excellent question. I think it would be almost impossible to finance it in 2 weeks, especially in a cooperative setting, this kind of purchase. With that said, I know, for example, I've heard 90 days bandied around. That seems actually excessively long. That seems unreasonable to this. I'm wondering if you were very delicate in the last one. I'm wondering if I can pin you down and what you think is actually a fair balance. This is not a loaded question. I genuinely don't know where to strike the balance.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barton, I'm going to be hard to pin down on that one because I don't know what the magic number is. I think there may be other people who are prepared to provide testimony on this bill who know a bit more about the technical assistance that's required in putting together these deals to tell you whether 60 days or 45 days is a reasonable and adequate time. But I'm not prepared with enough technical information to answer that.
Representative Riley?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I can tell you that my parents had 45 days, and it was touch and go. It was very tight time frame at 45 days, and they barely made it under the wire and almost lost their homes. So that's the only answer that I have.
Representative Krieger?
Mr. Chair, with our present mortgage market and how you qualify for loans, how close they look, and I've been through some of these homes, these mobile home places, a lot of them are old enough that you couldn't get enough value out of them to move them. They're not worth that much, and there's nothing to do with it. You see them sitting around on lots, you know, when people finally do pass on or have to leave. And I don't think 45 days is even going to get close in the climate that we're in now, that I could see us being in for the next 3-4 years. I don't know what's happened since last year. Did we have any of them sell where they were able to buy them? I don't know.
That's a question we're going to ask. I think Representative Wingard has been waiting down there to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm just curious and concerned, how would these are low income folks, how would they qualify to Representative Krieger's point, how would they qualify? And I'm also wondering, what's happening here is that the land is being sold for what would be termed a higher and better use, right? Which means somebody's making an upscale bid on the property, which, so I'm trying to figure out how the low-income tenants would be able to finance the value that they're being asked to match on somebody who's going to do mixed-use development or a commercial building or something very high-end with that property. I'm thinking specifically of a piece of property that's undergoing this transformation in my community of Wilsonville. How would they match it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wingard, the situation will be different from one park to another. The nature of the value of the homes, the value of the property, and the assets of the residents, it is really dramatically different from one location to another. It will most likely be a combination of their personal assets, grants, and loans, and maybe more than one kind of loan. There have been concepts that have been suggested, in fact I think we may hear some during this legislative session, to provide a revolving loan fund to help residents purchase their own parks. That would be part of an affordable housing strategy that we may hear. For example, for people to keep their affordable housing because, again, it's less it's more cost-effective to keep affordable housing that exists than to try to figure out how to build new, brand-new affordable housing, sometimes on land that's not even purchased yet. So when you look at the full cost accounting, I think that there are a number of organizations, associations, and even the state itself that understands the economics of the situation are likely that it's worth it to provide grants and various kinds of loans to help combine with the residents' own assets, even though, as you point out, sometimes the amount of assets they have access to is very, very small.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Widener and then Representative Cowan, and be cognizant that Representative Nathanson probably has other duties going on as well. So
this might be a question for someone later on who's going to be testifying, because I know your expertise probably isn't the greatest in this, but kind of following up on what Representative Wingard was saying, you know, I think we need to be careful on the burden we put on the owner of the property. How long does he need to be tied up because he might have an issue that he's dealing with. So I think this is something we need to look at very closely before we start regulating what we're going to do to these owners of the properties, because some of these homes or the parks, like the one we just had in our neighborhood, these homes were shot. I mean, they were leaking water, mold inside, and it was better to move the people out than let them keep living there in the park that they were in. So, I mean, the low-income housing, I don't know. I think there might be better options for us on some of these parks. So we need to take all this into consideration when we're looking at this bill. And if there are people that are in this industry, like I see a few out there that probably have some knowledge, I would like to hear from them on this if they're not signed up.
Well, there are several people signed up if we get to them. Representative Callan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and actually I'm trying to help you move this along.
Yes.
I just need to make the comment that I think it's important that existing law already provides that we have asked that the Owners Association be provided this opportunity, and we need to remember that we're not here debating whether or not they're able to do it, but simply this proposal that I appreciate Representative Nathanson bringing forward put some kind of a timeline on that that was missing in the law that was passed previously. And I think maybe we need to get away from debating whether or not one would be able to accomplish this feat. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Callan. Further questions, Representative Matthews?
Oh, no, thanks, Chair. I'll go ahead and defer.
Oh, that was a pass.
Okay. Yeah, that's a pass. Okay. Thank you.
Sort of like you're in a bidding auction. You move, you know, I call on you. Thank you very much, Representative Nathanson, for bringing this forward. And we're going to give it some thought and consideration. We'll hear from some other people who may have different ideas, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Have a good day. Next up, I'm going to jump to John Van Landingham and Pat Schwach. Welcome. Good afternoon, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Landingham with Pat Schwach, who's the lobbyist for the Oregon State Tennis Association, a statewide group of park residents. I am now a board member of OSTA, and I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County, and for the last, since 1995, I've represented tenant interests in legislation in Salem, and since 1991, and since 1997, park resident interests legislation in Salem. The chair and I saw a lot of each other last session in this very committee on a park closure bill, mobile home park closure bill 2735. I am the convener and chief draftsperson of a group called the Manufactured Housing Lobby Landlord Tenant Coalition, which has no official status at all, but consists of landlords and tenants, and we have since 97 produced a consensus bill amending state law on park tenancies. We have a bill that we just finalized this morning. It does not include this issue. It includes a couple of other issues. I would say to you that requiring landlords to negotiate in good faith with tenants is a very important issue. I've worked on a number of legislative issues related to park closures, primarily trying to follow what we call the New Hampshire model. In New Hampshire, the community loan fund there has facilitated the purchase of 90 parks in 25 years by the residents. In terms of park closures, that is probably the best solution to the dilemma that parks face. I would say to you, anybody in the Portland metro area, I would say to you that those parks are endangered species. And that's probably true for any place where real estate is highly valued, such as the Central Oregon area. As much as I appreciate Representative Nathanson bringing this forward, and I've known her since the early 1980s when I met her as a tenant advocate, we both began serving on the Eugene Planning Commission in 1987. I know that she cares greatly about this subject, but I can't support this bill. And let me try to explain why. This bill, in my opinion, does not advance the goal of helping residents purchase parks. In the New Hampshire model, there is no right of first refusal. There is instead a duty for the landlords to negotiate in good faith for 60 days with the tenants. We currently, in our statute, have a duty on landlords to negotiate in good faith with tenants, which is open-ended. There is no limit on it, period. I've had a respected landlord lawyer say to me that he's advised his clients that that effectively is a right of first refusal. So you might say, why not do this then? Two reasons. One, 14 days is not the same thing as an open-ended period of good faith negotiation. And you will hear from me and from others that 14 days, and Representative Riley's already mentioned this, 14 days is just not enough time to do what needs to be done. As I said, in New Hampshire, it's 60 days. 60 days itself is still tight. But so one problem is the open-ended nature of that. In the New Hampshire model, state law requires a landlord who wants to sell to first give notice to the state, as well as to all the tenants. The notice to the state allows the state to contact the community loan fund, a nonprofit. The community loan fund sends out park organizers into the park the very next day. I've been to a training there. I've been described as a disciple of the New Hampshire model. It's true. They have a big chart, daily chart, day one, day two, day three, on. And the first step is to go into the park and meet with the tenants, or ask if they want to meet, ask what, educate them about their rights, ask if they want to organize to buy the park, because they're going to have to form an entity to buy the park. They're going to have to decide whether they want to compete to buy the park. The next step is to help them find the financing. The next step is to make an offer to the landlord. The next step is to negotiate with the landlord. I mean, the landlord's not going to accept the first offer. This is a negotiation process that's going to go on. Our strategy in Oregon has been, from the time I got back from that training in New Hampshire in 2005, has been to follow the New Hampshire model. So 2735, which you passed last session, requires closing landlords to provide some assistance to tenants who are displaced where there is not a sale possible. It also provides a capital gains break that Representative Nathanson mentioned, so to encourage park landlords to sell to residents or to nonprofits or to housing authorities. We created last session, and a bill through this committee, HB 2096, something called the Nonprofit Cooperative, where residents own the park. Under Oregon law, otherwise, you cannot be both a nonprofit and a cooperative. You can be a cooperative, you can be a nonprofit, you can't be both. That law allows them to be both. And we also worked on funding. The legislature passed last session the expansion of something called the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. It's a lower loan rate for certain affordable kinds of housing by 4 percentage point, which is significant. You expanded that last session to include park purchases. So we can get cheap money. Some of the questions you asked already were, how does one finance a park purchase? That's one method. Second method is we're trying to create a loan fund, an equity fund with a document recording fee. HB 3551 came within three votes of passing the House last session. It's back. Had a hearing this morning in House Revenue. It passed out of House Revenue. It's moving to House Ways and Means. The Housing Alliance is hopeful that we will be able to move that bill this session. It would generate about $20 million in this biennium when the economy recovers more. Some of that money would be available for park purchases, the question that Representative Wingard asked. In addition, the governor has in his budget, I don't know if it'll hold, but the governor has in his budget $3.1 million in lottery-backed bonds specifically for park purchase. So we are working to identify that issue. In addition, there's another park purchase model other than the New Hampshire model, of which I'm a disciple of, managed in Oregon by a lawyer named Tony Wohler, which does not require public subsidy for the residents to buy the park. It works best with middle to upper income parks because the share prices that those residents pay is between $15,000 and $30,000. In the New Hampshire model, the residents pay a share price of about $500. So it's a very different model. There are a lot of things to say about the bill. If I were able to write my own bill, and I tried to do this in 2007 with 2735 and ran out of time, and I haven't had the ability to work on it since, I would like to have the time to work on it in the interim for 2011. I would like to do it jointly with the landlords and bring them with us. I think that it's going to require a successful sale. It's going to require a cooperative landlord. to make it work, because it's not going to happen in a 14-day period. It's probably not going to happen in a 60-day period without a cooperative landlord. But my ideal would be a statute that requires notice of sale to all the tenants, not just the three who happen to register with the landlord because they anticipate a sale, 90-day duty on the landlord to negotiate in good faith, a duty on the landlord to share any offers. How does a tenant compete with an offer when they don't know what the offer is? A duty on the landlord to tell the tenant why he or she is rejecting their offer so they can understand that and make a counteroffer. Some process for dealing with county offers. And then this is only about sales. Our crisis has been about closures,
yeah,
not about sales. That's where our crisis is. So what we do should address closures, not just sales. And we ought to clean up the existing statutes because they're a mess right now on that. That's my perfect plan.
Thank you for
cleaning up a mess. Hi, Pat, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
I will. My name is Pat Schwach, and I was an executive director. I'm the lobbyist for Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon, and we're the people who live in manufactured houses. And I have a little story that I want to tell that kind of points up all of this. The first park that was purchased in Oregon was a very beautiful park called Spring Lake out of Scappoose. And I worked real closely with Tony Waller and Dean to try and get this thing put together. We just sweat blood over that thing. And it took us almost 3 years to put it all together. And the only reason that it ever happened was because the owner was caught in the bite of the line and he was going to get a divorce and he wanted to get rid of this thing. So he stayed with the group and they managed to get it through. But I will tell you that Fred and I live in a park in Newburgh, and we had the opportunity, we thought, to buy the park. Suddenly, there'd been a letter go every year to the owner saying, in the event you decide to sell, we want purchased. And bless her little pointed head, she decided that everybody who lived in that park had to be not very good people, so there was no point in telling us. And she gifted our park to somebody else. Well, when we found out about it, we kind of began to squeeze her a little bit, and we kept her tied up for a whole year and a half. And we never were able to buy the park. She wasn't a willing seller, and she fought us all the way. And I think that's the key to it, that you must have a willing seller, somebody who really wants to deal with this, because it's not easy to put these things together. Believe me. That's my story.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. The first one is, once the owner has accepted an offer from some other party, why would he not accept an equal offer, and why shouldn't he be required to accept an equal offer from the park residents?
Chair Hovey, Representative Riley, I would not disagree with your premise. I think it would be very easy, though, to distinguish an offer, and I suspect that the resident group would have less financial clout, less financial experience. It wouldn't have a portfolio of properties. It would probably be not as secure a buyer as another buyer, and I think it would not be hard or difficult for a landlord to distinguish the resident group from the competing offer. So you're looking puzzled.
I am puzzled, yes.
I believe that if a landlord wanted to find an excuse to say that the tenant offer isn't as good as the competing original offer, that the landlord could, who had that incentive, could do that.
Why would they want to do that? I don't understand.
There's issues besides that. Further questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And Landingham. First of all, thank you for coming in. I have only done a little bit of work in this area of law. However, even in that little bit, your reputation for expertise in this matter does precede you. So, first of all, I genuinely understand your concern that what Representative Nathanson is trying to do might actually interfere, might actually undermine the current existing duty to negotiate in good faith.
Yep.
And you suggested, at least according to one lawyer's interpretation, that that duty to negotiate in good faith already essentially implies a duty a right of first refusal. Is there any case law to support that implication at all? I would feel far more comfortable if that were the case. That was my first question, and if I may ask a second question, with your permission, Mr. Chair.
At the same time, or you want me to answer the first one first?
It's related.
Okay, go ahead.
And my second one was, is there anything we could do today, then, to make sure that one does not undermine the other? Representative Nathanson's proposal does not, for legislative history, would that make you feel more comfortable? If we can make it complement instead of replace or undermine.
Chair Hovey, Representative Barton, there is no case law in Oregon, regarding ORS 90.820. Could we write this in a way that protects that? Of course. You could explicitly say that. The bill's a fairly simple bill. The good faith duty is in 90.820 sub 2 in the first sentence.
Right.
And Representative Nathanson has added a 14-day right of first refusal as a last sentence. So you could say that this does not offset or negate or limit the good faith duty to negotiate in the first part of this subsection. I'm a frequent user of, quote, legislative history to try to guide courts. Sometimes it works, and as a lawyer, you know that the Oregon courts look at the dictionary more than they do what you have to say. So there is that risk that it doesn't really help, but I do it myself quite a bit.
Representative Widener.
Just a quick question. Landlord-Tenant Coalition, is there a collaborative law agreement already put in place there with the landlords and tenants that's in place now with the existing law? Or?
So, Chair Hovey and Representative Widener, not on this issue. The coalition spent a ton of time last session negotiating HB 2735, the park closure law. We have barely survived that experience as a coalition. In a coalition, both sides give something and get something. The landlords felt burned by their experience in 2735, and we have taken a long time to try to rebuild that relationship. Our coalition build this session, we just signed off on it this morning at 11 a.m., and I gave it to Legislative Council this morning at about 5 a.m., and it includes three issues, not this. As I said, I would like to work this issue. It's been on my work list for a while. I mean, I've got a stack of papers here that's at least this thick with ideas and drafts. I've done a draft. It's 4 pages long. It's not one sentence. And I've negotiated it with Phil Quarin, a lawyer for the park landlords in Portland. I would like the opportunity to negotiate it, but I can't do it. I don't think it can be done with landlord cooperation this session. It's a slow process.
I would like you to see you do that.
Did either one of you want to testify on House Bill 2255?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I do. I'm the main movement.
Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2255.
Let me grab my notes.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. I guess I could have gave you a warning.
Should have anticipated that. Mr. Chair, thank you. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene, testifying in favor this time, thankfully, of HB 2255. So I've already talked a fair amount about our efforts to preserve manufactured housing parks in the state of Oregon. This bill is a continuation, or in some small cases, a correction of things that you did in the 07 session to help with park closures. We've long had the goal of encouraging residents to buy their own park. I've already described a couple of ways that you've taken steps to encourage that. This bill simply does four things that are part of that. First, as I mentioned earlier, HB 2096 last session created something called the Nonprofit Manufactured Dwelling Co-op, which is a resident-owned organization that buys a park. This bill would amend those statutes to make some corrections, improvements in how they work, primarily designed to do two things. One, to encourage lenders to lend on the homes in those parks. One of the great things about resident ownership of a park is that lenders treat the homes in New Hampshire as real estate. You may not be aware of this, but a manufactured home on rented space is treated as personal property as if it were an automobile. So the loan rate is not the same loan rate that you pay on your home. But if the bank will treat it as real estate, then the loan rate is great. And in New Hampshire, those residents are frequently able to renegotiate their loans, refinance their loans, get new loans, buy new homes, rehab their homes. It's a wonderful deal. They appreciate in value, comparable to stick-built homes. Manufactured homes on rented space and parks do not appreciate in value. So a number of the changes to the nonprofit co-op statutes are designed to make lenders feel more secure. For example, requiring that if a owner is going to be evicted from the park for not paying the dues, the co-op has to give notice to the lender. Lender has a right to cure. Lender has a right to step in and take possession of the home, to sell the home, or to move the home. In other words, protect the asset that secures the loan. I think they've left the room, but before they did, Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman assured me that OBA supports HB 2255. The goal is to encourage lenders to lend on homes. The second part of the bill that does that is to allow county assessors to record homes, manufactured homes, in resident-owned parks as real estate. So that's part of it. The other two main things that the bill does are this. In the process of adopting or getting you all to adopt 2096 last session, creating this co-op, DCBS, bless their hearts, showed up and said, we think this is a security. Membership in these co-ops is a security and would have to be regulated. That's not a good thing for us because it's going to add lawyers and money. And so we have spent the last 2 years working with DCBS to avoid that result. And Friday, at about 3 o'clock, we reached agreement with DCBS on rulemaking to do just that. DCBS has required in exchange that we make a couple of changes to the nonprofit manufactured dwelling park co-op statutes, for example, providing for no appreciation on the co-op memberships. Also providing that we can't call them membership co-op shares. We can only call them co-op memberships. But no appreciation on the memberships, because to DCBS that makes it an investment, and an investment ought to be regulated. It's probably not a huge deal to us because it's the home itself which appreciates in value, and we're talking about a low purchase price for a membership anyway. DCBS by rule has capped that at $1,000. The New Hampshire model is about $500. We can live with that. So we can make those changes. So again, one goal here is to address concerns of DCBS so that we not be treated as security. The last goal here is to make sure that public resources put into these parks, such as the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, is guaranteed to remain with that park for affordable housing or another charitable use, and not the Red Park couldn't cash out, take the money and move to the Bahamas. So that's a mistake I made last session. A creative person has found that mistake, and it needs to be fixed. The bill is not ready to move. It needs amendment. Our deal with DCBS was that if they adopted that rule, we would not put an exemption in statute. As you mentioned earlier, I agree with, rulemaking is always more flexible in statute. So DCBS now has a rule that they finalized on Friday, making our resident co-ops exempt from security regulation. We don't need in the statute. So the provision in the statute that would do that can go. We also continue to work on exactly how the co-op statutes work. We need to make some improvements there. And then finally, I mentioned earlier, there is another model of park purchase done with Tony Wohler. It's different than New Hampshire model. I believe that it too should be allowed to register as real estate and get the benefits of that. And Mr. Wohler was at the DCBS meeting on Friday, and he and I talked, and I think the reason he's not here this afternoon opposing 2255 is because I promised him that I would work on an amendment to include his model in that.
Thank you. And I see that you had someone listed to testify with you on House Bill 2255. And I know I have others still signed up for 2383, but I'm going to go ahead and take care of that testimony on 2255 right now.
Thanks, Chair Holvey. I'm Peggy McGuire. I'm the Community Resources Division Administrator at Oregon Housing and Community Services. And this has been a whole afternoon of alphabet soup and acronyms, and so I'll just give you another one. We have the Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Relations Program in our division. We call it the Resource Center, so that's easier. And we are also, as you know, the agency that works with developers to provide affordable housing opportunities. And we provide financing to put together the deals to for the co-op purchasers to work with the owners. And I guess I could, I have written testimony that's being passed out to you right now, and what I might as well cut to the chase and say is what he said. And just with one addition that with the financing, the most difficult piece is putting together the gap that, between what people can afford to pay for their park and what kind of financing package that we can put together to help them over the long term, and there's invariably always a gap. So anything that we can do to help these folks have more affordable housing costs on their home payment will close that, help to close that gap for us and help us spread some scarce resources to more parks and keep people from having to leave their communities and potentially become homeless, because as Representative Nathanson said, sometimes these homes, people just walk away from them. And we also do the case management for the folks that need to be relocated, the people that can't purchase their park for whatever reason. They're not able to put the co-op together, can't get the financing together. So we see the end results of people who are not able to purchase their parks. We understand that there are amendments that need to be made, and DCBS has been a great partner in working together with us and the other stakeholders to have a collaborative effort to have a bill that works for everybody, and we're fully supportive of that.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Either one of you might be able to contribute to this. We went through this last session, and I have forgotten the context, and you've helped me with your testimony. We have 1,200 parks in the state. Representative Nathanson testified that
270-some were closed. Does anybody remember that?
70. Representing maybe
270
residents.
180, yeah.
My question really is, if you could just, I'm not going to hold you to this, but if you could do approximations of the number of Oregon residents in those 1,200 parks, the number of purchases by tenant associations or how many associations there are, and just a word about the basic spread geographically in the state.
I can tell you some things, Representative Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam. I can tell you that in the park closure case management piece, in 2008, my staff member, Teresa Wingard, no relation, I'm told, who's the program coordinator for that program and does the case management, helped 984 residents who were not able to purchase their parks. And I'm only aware of three parks that were able to be converted to the co-op process, and two were done with the gentleman that John Van Landingham mentioned, and then one was done in conjunction with our agency with CASA of Oregon.
Chair Holy and Representative Gilliam, of those 1,300 parks, I think that represent about 60,000, 65,000 residents. Three parks have been purchased by the residents in Oregon in the last 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Two using the Tony Woller model, where the residents pay a significant amount of money as equity to buy the memberships, 15,000 to 30,000. One by using the New Hampshire model, done by the entity that we recruited in Oregon to be our New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, and that's CASA of Oregon. And Peter Hanley is here, I think, still unusually wearing a tie, who has completed one park purchase in McMinnville called Victor Manor. He also has another purchase that he's working on right now, and I believe Tony Woller has another purchase also. But we've only completed three, but we really only started about a year ago.
Do you have any people who are in all three parks?
No. I don't know the number of residents in those three parks. I think that Victor Manor is about 30, and the other two parks are about 45 to 60 units each.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them have so far been quite successful. But in the New Hampshire model, there have been no failures. Of those 90 purchases, none of them have failed, and I got to tour some of them.
And the geographic distribution.
I think parts are distributed throughout the state. The ones that were safe, Spring Lake is in Scappoose. There's one outside of Corvallis. Victor Manor is in McMinnville. The park that's being considered now is in River Road, Santa Clara area of Eugene. And the other park that Tony Wohler is pursuing is, I think, in Clackamas County.
And the ones that are closed are on the list.
Your colleague is also wearing a beard. I wanted to point that out to you.
I don't believe in beards myself, Chair Halvey.
Well, I want to try to keep this moving. I still have several people to testify. And unless somebody's got an important question they want to ask.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I heard you right. Did you say 65,000 people?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We believe that manufactured housing parks are the largest privately owned and supplied provided source of affordable housing in the country.
So good thing to keep
in
mind.
Yes.
Thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate all your work on this.
Thanks.
No doubt. With that, I'd like to go ahead and bring up Peter Hanley and Chuck Carpenter. I don't know if you're on the same side. Maybe I should have thought of that first.
I think we are.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Holdy, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation, CASA of Oregon, out of Newburgh, Oregon. And as has been referenced today, we are working on resident purchases throughout the state. We're a 501c3 organization. Primarily, we had worked developing farm worker housing. We've branched out since then to doing general low-income housing, including these park purchases. We also have an individual development account, match savings account program, and a U.S. Treasury certified community development fund. And while we'd like to be the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund of Oregon, we're just lacking the loan fund. They have about $50 million that's available for some of the secondary financing, and so we only have about $2.5 million in our fund. We have completed one park in McMinnville. We've got another one in Redmond that we've got a purchase option on that we'll be meeting next week with the owner and trustees, and hopefully we can finalize that. I'm testifying neutral on this bill. Our number one criteria for working with owners is that they're willing sellers. This bill, it goes from a notice of good faith negotiation to a right of first refusal within 14 days, and that's not going to work. It takes us 14 days to set up our first meeting with the residents if they're not organized. This is a very labor-intensive work that we do. We've got some grant funds from the state of Oregon, Oregon House of Community Services, from CFED, which is a national nonprofit in D.C. that supports wealth creation, and the Meyer Memorial Trust has contributed $100,000 to our loan fund to assist us in doing some of the secondary financing on this. While I would like to testify in favor of this, I know from doing development throughout the state that the best way to negotiate with a seller is willing and not to maybe try and ram something down their throat. So while I am supportive of good faith negotiation, this isn't going to do it. We also need to make sure that we can define what it is that's going to be in that notice. Does it contain all the sales price and all the terms? We need to understand if there's some penalty for non-compliance of not meeting this. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And as I stated, I'm neutral. I think I would welcome continued discussion with the committee, with community owners, residents, and other interested parties. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself
for
the record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm the Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent, we have members of about 500 communities across the state of Oregon. And I appreciate the discussion that we're having here today on this issue of right of first refusal. And I think the fact that there are so many questions that have been posed and the search for answers is one of the reasons why the association remains neutral. We realize this is an issue that will likely come up, that we will need to discuss further, but we would prefer that that discussion continue as all these issues have over the last 10, 15 years through what's been referred to as the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which is, as John Van Lanningham mentioned, sort of the group that gets together. Anyone interested in the manufactured housing community industry is invited, residents, banks, landlords, community owners, and we try to work these issues out. And this is, I think, a negotiation process that has produced over the last 10 years some really good legislation. Mandatory training, park closure bill from last year or the last session, which is one of the most generous park closure bills in the country, as well as right of first refusal, but subsequent sale. So there have been a lot of issues that in years past I think we have looked at as community owners and said there is no way we can come to agreement on these issues, that through a very intelligent and lengthy process we've come out with some very, very good proposals. So I'd like to ask the committee to sort of give us direction to go back and work this issue through and come back in the next session with some solid answers to the issues that you're talking about, and specifically with the issue of right of first refusal. How do we encourage landlords to continue to provide the affordable housing that they provide? How do we encourage them to sit down with organizations like CASA to put the financing together and be willing partners? I think that's the key to this whole thing, is going to be to have landlords who want to be willing partners. They are out there. And I would also like to note that when we start talking about park closures and the 70 park closures that we've had in the state, many of those have been conversions. In essence, the community has converted to a subdivision and people have bought the individual pieces of land that their homes sit on. So we realize that this is a very, very emotional issue on both sides, both from the landlord side and from the resident side. And we're happy to continue that discussion and to work with folks like CASA and with John Van Lanningham and the Oregon State Tenant Association to try to come up with win-win solutions, such as the omnibus bill that we're going to be proposing to you later this session that we just finished negotiation on. So I'd encourage you to let us go back and try to find the common ground that we need to find over the next 2 years and come back with a good proposal to you.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward and giving us your testimony today. I think I'm not seeing any questions of you right now, and we'll certainly revisit this issue. I'd like to get on with some other testimony.
Thank you very much.
Next up, I'm going to give the City of Wilsonville and City of Eugene, Greg Leo and Trevor Steele.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I will be brief. The City of Wilsonville has quite a history with this mobile home park bill issue. We're here in support today of the legislation brought forward. We think it will serve to clarify the issue for the tenants. In talking through the issue, we thought 60 days was just about the right balance of time in considering, the first right of refusal. So with that, I offer the testimony on behalf of the city, on behalf of House Bill 2383.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Trevor Steele with the City of Eugene, and I will also be brief. City of Eugene supports House Bill 2383. Over 20 years ago, the city became the first city in the state to provide protection for homeowners and manufactured home parks should the park close. That was actually passed in 1989. The underlying concepts of House Bill 2383 provide an additional tool that we feel can protect homeowners who are at a significant risk of losing their homes. Many of these owners, as was mentioned previously, are elderly or low income. If their manufactured home parks close, there's very little opportunity for them to relocate or to find alternative housing that's affordable. So the city supports the concept of a statewide protection. They found this bill, and we also want to recognize the hard work of Representative Nathanson on this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and duly noted for the record. Appreciate it. I'm going to move on to the next sign up. Last but not least, signed up first, so I apologize for going last, but Peter Ferris from the Oregon Manufactured Homeowner.
Thank you, Chairman Holby. I'm used to being last. I have what I'd like to do. My name is Peter Ferris. I'm the citizen lobbyist for the Oregon Manufactured Homeowners United. I live at Bayview Mobile Home Park in Walport, Oregon. And I'm here today in favor of the bill with some amendments, but I'd like to hand them out, but I would like to say a few things first regarding in response to some of the questions that have come up. I take a different approach on this, and in terms of, I'll have to say this to begin with, 2 years ago, it was this committee that passed some really good language that allowed us to have a partnership with local governments. The coalition wanted to preempt any ordinances, and there were a number of ordinances passed. And this is a kind of torturous history, but in any case, that's what happened. And we were successful in opening the door for five cities and one county. The thing that that did, and this is incredibly important, and I would say that Chair Holvey had the good public policy sense to do that, and I appreciate that. But the thing that that did was to empower us. One of the biggest problems in this equation is that the homeowners feel that there is no way, there's no option that the whole statute is against them. In many cases, it's not, but that's what they feel. And so what I would say to you is we need to have a partnership with local governments, and we also need to have something like this, right of first refusal. It's a small step, but it's meaningful because it says to the homeowners, you have something you can do. You have a possibility here. There is respect being shown to you by this, and I think that's very important. It's very critical. So I would disagree with John Van Landingham and Patchwalk because simply I think there's a kind of a slight psychological aspect to this and an empowerment issue. And if we don't do this, there's going to be no solution here. So that was one of the things I wanted to say. In terms of funding, I am now, I just was elected to the national board. And we are represented in 29 states. And what we're doing now is working with CFED and ROC USA, which is the New Hampshire model, to have a presence in Washington, D.C. I met with Senator Merkley, U.S. Senator Merkley, this last week because I was at the inauguration, and met with him to say, you know, why can't we have that waiver of federal capital gains tax, which is 16%? So if we were to take a look at that, 16 and 9, that'd be 25%. That would be a great incentive for park owners who want to be cooperative and want to give, you know, want to either mom and pops, usually they're mom and pops, maybe those people would be willing to see that as a real incentive and satisfy award the loyalty that these people have given the park owners for all these years. So that's and I think, you know, this is a work in progress. It's taking time, and it will take some more time in terms of getting the funding. I also want to say I want to give you a little context too about this, about what's happened in the last 15 years. In the last 15 years, we have seen a consolidation in the state of out-of-state corporations who have come in and have purchased parks, mostly from mom and pops, who are ready to retire. And what has happened is that these corporations have a different approach. What they do is they raise the rents way above CPI. They do minimal maintenance. They often are guilty of harassment of and political harassment of people who join an association and who are the leadership in the association. We have an instance right now in Clackamas County where this is the case. And so what they're waiting for, and what they were waiting for, is that they would leverage one park after another. They would then purchase another park, they would raise the rents, purchase another park, and the end result was they were waiting for a developer to cherry pick this park and make a killing. They don't, you know, that's what's happened. And you see, that's why, and they're the tail wagging the dog. They're the people, you know, we ask about, it's important to have a cooperative owner in terms of selling a park. That's true. But most with these kinds of people in there, people want to be a wannabe. You know, like, well, I like to make a killing too. And we saw what happened at Thunderbird in Wilsonville. You know, after Mr. Ash thought he was going to be a millionaire, he ends up still, after throwing everybody out of the park, 400 plus people, he still hasn't sold his land. There's no developer available. So, and you know, obviously this has a big impact. This has been impacted by the collapse of the housing market. I'm painting a picture of not all park owners. They're not created equal. I want to make that really clear. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that these large park owners are responsible for a lot of the grief. They simply are. And I think that empowering these people, the homeowners, is really critically important in this case. I would also say one other thing is that the reason why, Peter Hanley said that we passed the most generous bill last year in terms of park compensation. I'll tell you why it was. It's because we had five cities and one county step up and say, we want to do more for these people. We're not going to just give $5,000 or $7,000 to a homeowner when he leaves, even if he has a home worth $30,000 or $40,000. But we had these five cities and the county pass ordinances say market value. This is a failed concept if it is the mobile home park community is a failed concept if there's not a partnership. And there isn't a partnership in many cases. And this is the problem. No partnership. And I'd like to make partners with the park owners, but it's not happening. It's just, their incentive is now to raise the rents. Often we have a case right now in Washington County where water rates have gone up $90 in the last, past three utilities in $90 in the last 2 years, and 100 people have gone away. They have just left the park. Now, where did they go? We don't have a clue. But, you know, what does this say about good public policy. I don't see how this is good public policy. And whereas I think that probably John Van Lanningham is right in some ways about this is not the be-all or the send-all, this right of first refusal, I just think that we need to be encouraged as homeowners. We need to have this vision that someday we're going to have increased equity in a real community. Thank you very much. And if there's anything you'd like to ask me, I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much for your testimony. You're obviously passionate about this issue, and I appreciate you coming forward to testify on it. Committee, I don't see any burning questions for you. I just want to make sure we enter into the record the testimony of Eugene Hewlett. I think it was in our packet that was distributed. Is that right, Victoria? At least I got one.
It came to us somehow.
Oh, okay. So I just want to make sure that's entered into the record on House Bill 2383.
Chair Holvey, could I just mention about the situation there just very briefly? This is the park in Patrician Park in Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good, all I'll just say is that what's happened there is that there's a threat of closure there. And I have to say this much, that residents, homeowners have to get politically active. And that's part of this empowerment. Because what happens so often is that they stick their heads in the sand. They don't do the work that they should do in terms of being vigilant about a farming association and so on. And that's what happened in this case.
Thank you for that. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2383. And briefly, I'm going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 2199. Committee, I failed to enter into the record written testimony of the Credit Union Association, presented by Pam Levitt. So I apologize to her.
Yep.
She's not here, but I'd like to enter that into the record as well.
I don't have it.
And if you don't have a copy of that, let me know.
Yeah.
And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2199. Committee, next on Wednesday, we will be having a public hearing on House Bill 2270 and House Bill 2366. And we will carry over House Bill 2354 till Wednesday. We will not be having a work session on House Bill 2190. With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Before you adjourn, will we be having a meeting on Friday, Mr. Chair?
It is not my intention at this point in time.
Thank you.
Here, that's good, Chair.
With that, adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Have you got a date on Friday, Carolyn?
I'm sorry?
I've got a
notice that the chair doesn't even ask me.
I'm concerned about you. We're still on the, our sound's still up, though, I think. So.
I'll be happy to. I think we'll also, adjust the blinds before we start.
Yeah.